How was the Declaration of Independence a masterstroke of propaganda? How did revolutionary figures like Ben Franklin, Mercy Otis Warren, and Tom Paine rely on the rapid dissemination of information to influence popular opinion? What links do we see between propaganda in 1776 and modern phenomena such as WikiLeaks, fake news, and fan fiction? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest this hour is Russ Castronovo, Tom Paine Professor of English and Chair of the English Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll be talking about the subject of his book, Propaganda 1776, Secrets, Leaks, and Revolutionary Communications in Early America. Welcome to University of the Air.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So I always am interested in what drives people to spend a lot of time doing the research and writing behind a book. What led you to this Propaganda 1776 book?
Actually, I thought of this book began with a in the Harlem Renaissance for me.
Okay.
Yes, I know. And I was reading a lot of work by a black artist and black writers who in the 1920s thought it was very important and significant to stem the tide of racism by writing a certain type of fiction and poetry. And within that, there's a quote that W.E. Du Bois came up in 1926. He says, "All art is propaganda and ever must be. And I don't care a damn for any art that is not propaganda." And so what that did was it led me on this backwards. I thought it was going to lead me forwards, but it led me back first to Tom Paine and then all these other figures that you describe. And so it was, you know, I'm trying to get up to the present moment, but, you know, as you know, scholarship and academia often takes us in the reverse course. And this is a perfect instance of that.
Yeah, I've got that Du Bois quote. Your book made me think of it. So let me read the whole thing here. "All art is propaganda and ever must be, despite the wailing of the purists. I stand in utter shamelessness and say that whatever art I have for writing has been used always for propaganda, for gaining the right of black folk to love and enjoy. I do not care a damn for any art that is not used for propaganda." That really redefines propaganda for me. And I wonder if we could, before we go further on the early American propaganda, let's just talk about that term, propaganda. What does it mean? What did it mean?
Right. So when Du Bois is using it, it doesn't have a pejorative sensibility, right? That only accrues to propaganda in after World War I, when people look at all the what we would call fake news or false reporting or types of reporting that was circulating about German atrocities and also that encouraged the U.S. involvement in this, you know, disastrous war. And so before that, though, before it becomes laden with negative connotations, propaganda is more a more neutral term that simply alerts us to thinking about how things circulate, how they disseminate, how they travel, how they get received. And that's very much what I wanted to think about in this book, was thinking about how in 1776 or in another era, one gets one's messages across to the widest amount of people.
I kind of felt silly that I hadn't even thought about the link between the word propaganda and propagate. Obviously, it's an obvious connection, but can you say something about that and also the link back to the Catholic Church and its notion of propagation?
Right. So I think that let's start with the Catholic Church, first of all. So the Catholic Church had a society for the propagation of the faith. And within that, we can see that they did not think that propaganda was false. Indeed, they think they are circulating the one true word of God, right? And so propaganda, it's best works when you're spreading the truth, right? So that's the thing. It doesn't necessarily imply falsity. And so for the Catholic Church and others, it really was a way of strategizing the post office, about strategizing uses of the vernacular, about using the papal see and cardinals to get the message out there. Within that, the church back in the 1500s is pulling upon Latin writers like Cicero, who talked about propaganda or the propagum in specifically horticultural or agricultural terms that you're referring to, right? And to propagate something, really you had this notion of seeding a terrain so that by shoots and runners like we do in our gardens, you could spread, you know, the word of the Roman Empire across its dominion. And so it's related to conquest, but it also really is about information. It's about letters. It's about facts. It's about rumors. It's about creating a network, if you will, in which information moves and travels.
I was struck to see the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, we think about every 4th of July, and it's this big moment in American history, this patriotic essay, this wonderful rhetoric, to see it referred to, I think it was by the nephew of Sigmund Freud, as the masterstroke of propaganda. Tell me about the Declaration.
I'm infatuated with Jefferson's words, and they really are immortal. But what I wanted to do when writing this book is I wanted to get beneath Jefferson's words, or let's say alongside them. I was really curious about how his words circulate. So we know Jefferson's words because it comes to us in so many forms, from school age to political debates today. But what was really important, I think, about Jefferson's declaration was that it fit on a single page of broadside. It couldn't be too long, right? And that seemed to me one of the things about the masterstroke of propaganda was, how do you write something that can fit on a single sheet of paper, which is not unlike, I would say, how do you get your message across in a 30-second spot on the radio or on television or a short, you know, sidebar on the internet? I think Jefferson's dilemma or his task was something similar to that, right? How do I get these soaring truths across to a wide population in this convenient form? And again in the book, the people I look at, Tom Paine, Mercy Otis Warren, Ben Franklin, this is what they grappled with. It didn't necessarily imply brevity all the time, but it implied a certain compactness and a certain allure that would make this a really compelling message.
How did it spread? I mean, we're so used to instant communication globally, but for something like the Declaration on a broadside, how did it reach people?
Well, you know, it's a really contested history of the Declaration's publication and when it comes out. In fact, when I was writing the book, I was profited from a historian who said, "You actually have this all wrong." And historians know about how the Declaration is, I think. And I'm going to get this all wrong one more time. I think it's like approved in Congress on July 2nd, but it actually doesn't circulate to July 5th. But for me, it was this broadside printed in by this in this one printing house that allowed it to circulate. And one of the things I have in the book is I have all these copies of the Declaration of Independence. And we like to think of the Declaration of Independence in this, you know, elaborate cursive script that is flawless. But the broadsides that I have in the book, they show signs of smudging, right?
Increases.
Yeah. And what it suggests is that it was printed up and folded over right before the ink had a chance to dry. And to me, that's important because you can see that speed, celerity, quickness was also an important feature of the message. So it's not only about spreading something widely, propaganda, but in some cases, it's about spreading something quickly, right? Almost, let's say, and I know this may be heretical when we're thinking about the Declaration of Independence, but before people have time to think, right, that you have to have that message moving at a quick pace.
Well, you know, I know you caution in the book also about not necessarily linking something from 1776 to the 20th or 21st century, but the title of your first chapter is State Secrets, Ben Franklin and WikiLeaks. That invites us, it seems to me, to take this sort of American icon, Benjamin Franklin, and then think of WikiLeaks, which is in the news all the time. Can you sort of set the scene here? How is Benjamin Franklin and his story of what happened connected to propaganda and also connected in some way to WikiLeaks?
Well, so this, I'm going to tell you the real story behind how I thought of this. I'm a soccer parent, and traveling across the strait with other soccer parents, they always ask, what do I do as a professor? And I was telling them that I was working on Ben Franklin. And as I would explain this to them on these long car rides to like Richland Center and other places across the state, I found that the only way I could explain what I was talking about with Ben Franklin was to actually refer to Bradley Manning, or now Chelsea Manning, and WikiLeaks. And what I was interested in particular, is how Ben Franklin gets a message, how information is leaked to him, very sensitive information about the British Empire and its plan to perhaps curtail the liberties of Americans living in the colonies. Franklin has to figure out how to get this message out there. How is he going to disseminate it? How is he going to, if we will, propagate it? And that is very much the subject of the chapter. And I could only figure out how to tell that story by thinking about Chelsea Manning. And if just to continue for a second here, what Chelsea Manning does is Chelsea Manning recognizes the importance of not putting herself in the center of the story, right? How do you just act as a node, a hub through which information passes? And so I describe all the stratagems, ruses, tricks, clever inventions that Ben Franklin used to allow this very sensitive information to pass through him, but where things wouldn't get stuck to Ben Franklin. Because if Ben Franklin became important as the personality, then the information is never going to get anywhere. So Ben Franklin had to create a certain type of anonymity so that he was a cipher, a sort of conduit through which information could pass. I think in the book I talk about it at one point how when Ben Franklin's living in London and he's pilfering these stolen messages, he's using, I think, 43 different pseudonyms. Right, which we could think about as our online personae, to communicate with people back in the colonies. So that's what I wanted to do. And so it wasn't for me, you know, I was trying to think about how something in our current moment, WikiLeaks, illuminates something from the founding moment, but also vice versa, how something from the founding moment illuminates what is happening in the 21st century and how we receive and process information.
So this information that Benjamin Franklin was given, do we know who gave it to him?
Well, the interesting thing is that there are many candidates out there now who might have given Franklin the information. Back in 1773, when Franklin is facilitating this link, no one knows who gave Franklin the information. They don't even know that Franklin is involved. So there are a lot of scurrilous rumors flying about, a lot of accusations, and one man accuses another of leaking this very sensitive information to the crown, and a sword fight ensues. Franklin is mortified that this has happened. There's going to be another duel, so he steps up and says, "I will tell. I am the one who sent this letter to back to the colonies where it's creating all this havoc." And again, what the letter showed was that England may have had a plan to curtail the liberties of Britain's the colonists of British North America. So Franklin divulges his role in passing the information, but he refuses until this day, right, to say who it was that exactly gave him the information.
So he protected his source.
He protected his source, and most importantly to Franklin, he protected himself.
Now, I might have gotten it mixed up because there's so many scurrilous reports and leaked things running throughout your book here, but was this the stuff that also had to do with Governor Hutchinson?
Yes. Right. So what he's leaking is one of Governor Hutchinson's, Thomas Hutchinson, who's the governor of the colony of Massachusetts. He has a very sensitive piece of information that he's communicated to the crown. Franklin gets a hold of that letter. And so disastrous is it that Hutchinson, within 2 years, or I think even within a year, has to give up his post as governor. And even though he himself is an American-born Briton, he then has to take exile or take refuge in Britain. He never returns to his native land, which was America. Franklin, interestingly enough, is excoriated in the British press. And there's a trial to which he is summoned. And he is lambasted there. He is denounced as not a gentleman, as a pilferer of secrets, as a reprobate, as a scoundrel. And Franklin sits there the whole time not saying a word. And to set the scene a little bit more, they did it in this place called the Cockpit, which is where they used to have bear baiting and cockfights. And Franklin, when he later recalls the scene, talks about how it is like another bear baiting for him. He is there subject to all the lords and ladies who have come to watch a show. And the show is to see Franklin vilified before all the British peerage. Again, as I said, Franklin is completely silent during all this. He doesn't offer a defense. But the rumor has it, according to one account, that when Franklin is leaving this tribunal, he leans over to the Solicitor General who has been denouncing him for the better part of an hour and says, "I will make your master, King George, I will make your master a little king, for this. And that really shifted the tide for Franklin. And Franklin had been loyal in some ways to the crown up to that point. But seeing how dastardly and how poorly they treated him, he then became, you know, a fierce patriot.
Do we know if what he leaked was true?
It was true, but it was taken out of context, we should say. There was it's unclear what so I should read the line. If you give me a second here, I think I can find it. What Hutchinson had written in a letter of January 20th, 1769, which Franklin is now leaking in 1773, so 4 years elapse, is this phrase. And Franklin releases the whole letter, but there's one phrase that sticks out. And the governor of Hutchinson is writing back to England, and he says, quote, "There must be an abridgment of what are called English liberties in America." And what's interesting here is that it's all how you take that word must, right? On the one hand, he could be saying, this has to happen. If we're ever going to continue to govern these colonies, we have to get rid of liberty in America. Or, as probably was more likely, although Franklin wouldn't really credit this interpretation, was Hutchinson was saying, if the situation continues, if the chaos doesn't stop, if we don't put an end to this political dissension, there must be an abridgment of liberties, that liberties are naturally going to fade away. So Hutchinson might not have been selling out his comrades as much as Franklin and other patriots like Sam Adams and Mercy Otis Warren wanted people to believe, but it really didn't matter what Hutchinson thought, right? His intention is beside the point, because once he wrote that, once Franklin got a hold of it, and once the press began to circulate it, it didn't matter what he had said anymore. Right. All that mattered was the meaning that people affixed to it. And this is the story that I see again and again with propaganda, that you have an original meaning, but it's foolhardy to believe that you can control that original meaning, that you can somehow control your message. And we see this all the time with memes, with comments across our contemporary media scape, that a message, once you utter it, it no longer belongs to you. And the point of the book is, it belongs to the public.
And it spreads like wildfire. It propagates.
Right. And how are you going to put... So if we have something out there about ourselves, or like as Governor Hutchinson did, how are you going to put an end to... How are you going to put out the fire?
Even if it's false, it's still spreading.
Yeah, especially if it's false.
More on Propaganda 1776 when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Propaganda is to a democracy what violence is to a dictatorship, so said William Bloom. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Russ Castronovo. We are talking about his book, Propaganda 1776, Secrets, Leaks, and Revolutionary Communications in Early America. We were talking about Benjamin Franklin and his involvement in leaking sort of negative press about the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Let's turn to a figure that I did not recognize the way I did with Ben Franklin, but a fascinating woman. You write about Mercy Otis Warren. Tell us about her.
Well, you're right, Emily. She is fascinating. I think she was my favorite figure in the book that I got to spend some time with. So she's the sister of James Otis. James Otis is the person who historians suggest came up with the phrase taxation without representation. She and James Otis are educated the same in a classical education by their parents, which was rare at that time, right, for women to have the same educational opportunities as a man. Her brother is a firebrand. He is uncompromising. He calls out British officials when he thinks what they're doing is corrupt. He goes to a tavern one day and a man who, a British officer who feels that he's been slandered by James Otis, takes out his cane and beats him senseless. And James Otis is never the same again. He, suffers brain damage from this attack. And Mercy Otis Warren takes up her brother's cause. Mm-hmm. She takes up her pen, and she is going to go after the very system, the very government of Massachusetts that she saw on a personal level that had attacked her brother, but that she also, and this is what I think her real insight was, that she could see that what had happened to her brother was happening in other ways, through taxation, through the quartering of soldiers, through especially through government corruption all across her colony. And so who she goes after in a series of anonymous poems and plays is the, none other than the governor of Massachusetts himself, Thomas Hutchinson, who we've met already. Mm-hmm.
I think if I remember right from reading about Anne Bradstreet, America's first woman poet, wasn't Hutchinson also the one who said that women who did too much reading and writing could go insane and came out pretty strongly against women learning? I'm just thinking about this Mercy Otis Warren right. and her courage in speaking out. But you said she published anonymously. Was that to protect herself from the kind of fallout that would happen?
Yes, it was to protect herself. And in fact, there's a point where I can't remember the language in the book, but it would be interesting to see there's a parson. And I think they say a nosy parson or a talkative parson lets out that Mercy Otis Warren might have written this play. And there's a certain scrambling by John Adams and Mercy Otis Warren's husband, General Joseph Warren, or John Warren, because there's two Warrens, sorry. But there's a certain scrambling by the men in her life to make sure that her identity remains cloaked.
So what makes her work propaganda, though? Because if she's writing plays where she's sort of satirizing certain political situations or pamphlets or, you know, putting her opinions out there, what makes it deserve to be called propaganda?
Okay, there are two things, I think. The first is how she was able to invent a certain moniker for the governor that was going to travel widely across the colonies. And that, in her play, she writes this allegory of a republic that is being beset by all sorts of underhanded governance. And the name of that governor in the play is Rapacio, which is like the word rapacity or rapaciousness.
Greed.
Yeah. or rape.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed was, I was like, wow, this is such a strange name. And I did a little research, and I just should find this very quickly. But after Mercy Otis Warren dubs the governor Rapacio, all sorts of rapacity began appearing in the American press. So let me just give you a quick example here. Before she publishes this play called The Adulator, one who's like kind of a false flatterer, on March 26, 1773, there are just six instances of the word rapacity that I could find in the colonial press. But after she publishes the play and through 1777, suddenly there are 138 instances of the word rapacity. Mm-hmm. Or like the word rapacious. Before the year previous its publication, I could just find three instances of the word rapacious in the American press. But afterwards, in American newspapers, there are 118 instances of rapacious. So what she did was she created this character, and it's helping her countrymen and women think of this colonial administration of Massachusetts as one based on, and the word you noted is quite apt, greed.
And are people encountering this as a play that's being performed? Are they just reading it as it's being printed?
Right. It's never performed.
Never performed.
It's just being put in the newspapers in installments, and then it gets picked up from newspaper to newspaper, you know, throughout the colonies.
Just, and did it have a pseudonym, or did it just say anonymous, or was it like? I mean, did people know that it was by a woman?
I don't believe people knew it was by a woman. Mm-hmm. It might have said that. That's an interesting question. I'm trying to think back to those facsimile pages of the early of like the Massachusetts Spy, where it appeared. And seeing if it's like the adulator by a woman. But I don't know if that's the case.
And I think you point out in your book that she, along with Abigail Adams with the Remember the Ladies, that mm-hmm. they were sort of trying to insert something about women into the discussion at this point.
Yes.
Trying to get that as something that people would consider.
Yeah, Abigail Adams was her closest confidant, I think. And James Adams, too. She has these long letters that she and John Adams exchange, where she's asking John his advice. Do we think it's okay to satirize leaders? Mm-hmm. She's wondering, is satire an ethical way to communicate one's message? And he's like, by all means. And she's like, well, in that case, move ahead. And so what you see there, though, I think, is that you have a woman who is engaging one of the political leaders of the day in a very serious intellectual discussion that has political consequences about what is the role of satire. And so I think that's a real model for a certain type of public discourse and intellectual exchange that leads to a certain type of freedom, expansive discourse, and radical activism.
I guess one thing that struck me as I read the parts about Mercy Otis Warren in your book is, it's a kind of embarrassment because I hadn't actually heard of her, but I've done a lot of work with early women writers and attitudes toward mm-hmm. women writers and figures, and it seems increasingly, and that included with some of the things that were in the musical Hamilton or just
sure.
other things, is you feel like, what was this American history I was given? It was a very sort of stately and whitewashed history, and it didn't have a lot of these figures that now are coming to light or some of the information about false news and rumors and scandals. Somehow we weren't fed that information in the right way.
Right. And, and that's exactly the case. But if you and I know that if you have a literate culture, and let's take, Massachusetts or New York or Pennsylvania in the 1770s, and political communication is happening by letter, right? The letter is the primary medium for communicating of political associates across the colonies. Well, who are the great letter writers of their time? Sure, it's people like Samuel Adams and Thomas Jefferson and John Hancock, but we also have to remember that women are writing letters all the time, and so that you can see as I read through the letters of Mercy Otis Warren and Abigail Adams, and that she's talking about troop movements, she's talking about political questions of the day. So she's helping to communicate information. And she also says, and this is something that is true to the case, is that the key component of political communication in Massachusetts and across the colonies were these committees of correspondence in which various towns agreed they would share political information. And that's how you use a network to create unity. Mercy Otis Warren says that the idea for the committees for correspondence was created in her drawing room.
Hmm.
And I think that's because, again, women were these, great letter writers. And there really weren't, you were just as happy in that day to receive a letter from any talented correspondent, someone who had, beautiful penmanship, someone who could, sprinkle their letters with appropriate classical allusions. And all that was the case with Mercy Otis Warren.
Can you link her to anything in modern times the way you had with Benjamin Franklin and WikiLeaks? If you were talking to someone on a way to a soccer game and you're talking about Mercy Otis Warren and trying to sort of make her seem as if she's linked in some way to something we find familiar, would it be with her use of satire, with the sort of the power that late night comedians might have, spoofs? Takeoffs, send-offs, or what would you link her to?
Yeah, I like to think of, when I was writing the chapter, I thought about Jon Stewart mm-hmm. a lot and The Daily Show and how he would have his way of referring to whatever political personage he was talking about. And it became a type of shorthand, a type of code for compacting a lot of information in a single a word or in a single mm-hmm. phrase. And I think that's who I would compare her to. But I should have a cautionary note to all this. So like Ben Franklin, and Mercy Otis Warren doesn't want to be at the center of things. For her, it's about the information. It's not about being an author. In the 18th century, she might have been called an authoress, right? Mm-hmm. It's about being a reliable spirited conduit for information. So in her play that she writes, and this is this, I said there were two ways that she was a propagandist. This is the second way. She writes scenes that are incomplete. And she says that others, when they read this drama, may want to add to these scenes. They may want to contribute their own dramatization of other ways in which the governor of Massachusetts, Hutchinson, and his family, who occupied a key political post in the colony because he appointed them to those posts, the ways in which they are corrupt. And feel free to go ahead and write these scenes. And she provides cues in her play and saying, like, here would be a good spot if you wanted to try your hand at, you know, pillorying the Hutchinson and his family. And indeed, that's what happened. Other versions of her dramas circulate, or new versions circulate with added scenes by other people who share a political sensibility. So patriot writers, not just Mercy Otis Warren, suddenly take up this drama of Rapatio and add to it, embellish it, and expand it. And so within that, we can see that Mercy Otis Warren, she, you know, you or I, if we were to write a book and somebody were to do that with our book, we would be screaming copyright, right? we would be, you know, hoping to get our royalties, right? That's not what's involved for her. What's involved for her, again, is that message. She doesn't need to be known as an author, right? She has, in fact, a weak sense of authorship. What's more important to her is the political cause that she's talking about. And if that means, like Ben Franklin, she has to recede to the sidelines, that she has to stay in the shadows, so be it. Because there's this other more important thing that we have to make sure is propagated.
But you would argue that despite the fact that she's in the shadows, that we don't know her that well, despite that, that what she did, what she wrote, and how it was disseminated played a role, an important role in the American Revolution?
It's hard to create a direct line, mm-hmm. but I think, you know, what she wrote was important to galvanizing public sentiment. And that's, you know, 1773, right? There are a lot of people in the colonies who are very loyal to the crown still, right? They haven't mm-hmm. chosen sides. And for her, it was paramount that she begin to shift public opinion away from Britain and towards this inchoate thing that what was, there was no, you know, United States of America in 1773. There was no Declaration of Independence yet. So how is she going to begin to shift that tide? And that's, well, I think she played a key role in that, as did her other, you know, unnamed, you know, lost propagandist of the day.
And she's, I suppose, illustrating the importance of freedom of the press. I mean, nobody's censoring her.
Nobody's censoring her, you know, and the press was a, you know, to mix historical metaphors, it was the Wild West in the 1770s. I mean, you know, rumors could be printed. There are, you know, newspapers spring up, they fold, but it's a vibrant public sphere at the time, and there is no censorship, right? There are libel. There's worry about libel, but then that's why you publish anonymously.
So, in our time, we've heard about alternative facts, fake news. Mm. What about at this time in the 1770s leading up to 1776? What examples do you have of fake news, fake facts, things that are deliberately created to mislead?
While there was fake news, one of the things that people like to do, and I think Tom Paine excelled at this, was to invent a persona as though this person were actually speaking to the public. And so what Tom Paine does in this case is he writes the soliloquy of this guy named Lord Clive. And Lord Clive was a British general who had been active in India.
Now, this is a made-up figure, or there was a Lord Clive?
There is a real Lord Clive.
Okay.
But what Paine does is he invents this soliloquy by Lord Clive, in which Clive, who is famous for doing two things, or infamous for doing two things. One is for engaging in imperialism in India. He did so brutally, Right. You know, massive battles, which either there's torture, there's, you know, most importantly, there's famine that, you know, Clive's administration is allowing to proceed. That's one of the first things that Clive does. The second thing is that around Clive, there's this discourse circulating that maybe we should try to subdue the American colonies in the same way we've subdued the British India. And so what Paine does is he writes this soliloquy that Lord Clive is giving, in which he meditates on these very things. And in doing so, he exposes Clive as not only someone who decamped from India with all its riches, right? So that's one of the things about imperialism. He's a successful imperialist. Mm-hmm. He, you know, pilfers the coffers of India and jewels, crown and jewels, spices, all the things that you would get in the East, brings it back to London so he can become like a marquis. And Paine has him with a soliloquy saying, wow, isn't it so wonderful that I am now, you know, wealthy. I'm one of the 1% in England, and this is what English imperialism has got me. But on the other hand, he begins to have remorse in this soliloquy. He thinks about all the barbarities that he perpetrated in India, all the atrocities. And it so happens that Clive later commits suicide in real life. And what Paine is purporting to give us is this man's soliloquy before he commits suicide. So what does this do? What does this fake news do? Well, I think he's trying to show people this is the psychological toll of practicing a certain type of mercantile imperialism in the colonies. So Paine here was drawing upon real figure, but making it fake in a way to communicate a real truth.
Now, is that fake news or is that literature?
Yeah. There's the
because you said soliloquy would supply, you know, that would suggest it's a speech almost like out of a play, more like Mercy Otis Warren. But is Paine presenting it as if it could actually have been said by Clive? Because it seems to me there's a real difference in presentation.
You know, I don't know that people would think that Clive really said it, but it is appearing in a newspaper.
Okay.
It is appearing in print, and it's just called the Soliloquy of Lord Clive.
And I suppose it also is making those in America start linking the British treatment of the colonies to what happened in India.
Right, and that's the big fear, is that you know, and quite simply, this is the fear that white people living in the Americas are worried that they're going to be treated as brown people in Asia.
Treated rapaciously.
Right, thank you. But, you know, so the thing that's curious about this is, and to follow up on your question, is the American newspaper at this time is not the orderly affair that we now have. It doesn't have a news section. It doesn't have an opinion section. It doesn't have a sports section. It doesn't even have an advertising section, although it does, sometimes the last and first pages are advertising. Instead, it's all mixed together, right? So you could have a news item about these are the ships that arrived in the harbor. And they're carrying these types of goods. That's factual. And then right below it, there'll be this invented soliloquy. But to get to fake news in another way, because I think this is a really crucial question. And I should say that the 2016 election has made me revisit this book and question a lot of the conclusions that I draw. And one thing that comes to mind is I look at how the British at one point were circulating fake news about George Washington. So remember how the British had Thomas Hetchinson's letter stolen. Well, what they then said was, what we have are George Washington's letters. And they printed the quote-unquote letters of George Washington, which he's writing to Martha back at Mount Vernon. And he says things like, oh, dear Martha, I really think I made a bad choice here. You know, why did I ever decide to be traitor to so good a king? Mm. Or he says things like, you know, this is not going to work out well. There's so much dissension in our ranks. You know, the northern, the representatives of the northern colonies are fighting with the ones in the south. We're hardly a unified force. I really lament this course of action I've taken. And it seemed like George Washington was writing these things. But this was indeed the invention of a British propagandist who disseminated this this pamphlet, occasionally calling itself the True Letters of George Washington.
Ooh, putting true in the title.
Right, right. And it wasn't taken as, even the British press, I should say, saw through this and said, this probably isn't George Washington who was writing these things. And you have to remember that George Washington was in many ways revered in Britain by in quarters. I mean, in various quarters. People thought he was an honorable, brave, you know, courageous leader. And indeed, in many respects, he was. So that would seem to end in the 1770s, when this after the war. But one of the things I was curious about in this book was back later, 20 years later, in the 1790s, through a very complicated turn of events, George Washington's opponents get a hold of these letters. And they're mad at Washington over this thing called the Jay Treaty, because they think it's making England and America too fast of friends. And they recirculate these letters that were proven false in the 1770s. But these Americans who are against Washington in the 1790s recirculate them now as if they were true.
So you've got recycling propaganda.
Yeah. Right. So what was presented as true, denounced as fake, later becomes true again. And so it's a very topsy-turvy world to kind of track this. And so we think that that it's only our sophisticated technology of a digital age in which we have to be alert to how information is moving and its truth value. But we can see that this is something that, you know, we have to be attentive to in this era as well. And I think, you know, again, that sort of that historical comparison of trying to figure out, does something in 1776, the era of 1776, does it work as a compass for figuring out where we are in the 21st century? At the same time, as we look back from the 21st century to an earlier moment, it allows us to see that, you know, what we're dealing with is not necessarily unique.
And not new. We're going to have some final thoughts about Propaganda 1776 when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. As well can the lover forgive the ravisher of his mistress as the continent forgive the murders of Britain. So said Tom Paine. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Russ Castronovo, and we are talking about Propaganda 1776, Secrets, Leaks, and Revolutionary Communications in Early America. I noticed that, you know, when you chose a name for your named professorship, which is an honor that you have and you get to choose a name, you decided to call yourself the Tom Paine Professor of English. Why?
Well, I was, the university said to me, you are now a named professor and you get to choose the name. But with this proviso, it should have some connection to Wisconsin. And I was thinking, wow, American literature in Wisconsin. I was having a hard time thinking of many leading lights. I know that Ralph Waldo Emerson lectured at the University of Wisconsin back in the 19th century, but somehow the Ralph Waldo Emerson Chair of American Literature sounded kind of stuffy.
I think Sinclair Lewis spent 6 weeks here and then left in disgust.
So I was at a loss. And then I was actually reminded of the fact that doing another radio show that had a call-in component, and I was doing this radio show on Tom Paine, a gentleman called in from Paineville, Wisconsin, and he proceeded to give me a history lesson, which was very welcome, about how German immigrants who settled in Wisconsin in the 1840s were so enamored of Tom Paine's ideas of liberty that they named their town Paineville. And I thought, this is perfect. I have not only do I have an excuse now for calling myself the Tom Paine Professor of English, but I now begin to understand something about Tom Paine's international, transnational reach and why this idea of liberty not just the idea, but the way that he communicated it would have spread so widely into, you know, different languages across the continent of Europe.
We think of his pamphlet, Common Sense, which is has a name that makes you think this is kind of almost the opposite of propaganda or persuasion or rhetoric. Is that what stood out for you? Is his work Common Sense, or just sort of the whole scope of his life and work?
You know, I teach Common Sense every year, so it remains a real sounding board for my thoughts. But I was also interested in Paine's poetry, his other pamphlets, The American Crisis, all his work. And then the thing that's amazing to me is that Tom Paine is such a fierce advocate of liberty that knowing no French after the American Revolution, he leaves for France and says, I'm going to participate in your revolution. and he narrowly, only narrowly does he escape the guillotine through a long, very kind of long story. But just to kind of bring things full circle, he blames George Washington for letting him rot in this Parisian dungeon for years and years, for not sending an emissary to get him out. And he then, when he does is finally released, only narrowly escaping death, execution, he writes this infamous letter called Letter to George Washington, in which he kind of says, well, George, remember we had a King of England? You're acting a little bit like him. And from that point on, Paine, after having attacked Washington, is persona non grata in the United States. And he becomes kind of synonymous with an overzealous radical.
So do you like him because of his honesty, his passion, his...
I like him because I think he understood that the cause of liberty, that the cause of democracy really wasn't a national quest. It needed to be international. It needed to be hemispheric. It needed to be Atlantic in scope. So Paine, what he's interested in is not the creation of a United States. Right. What he's interested in is taking this notion of democracy, of human freedom, and transporting it across the globe. So much so that he's a fierce anti-slavery advocate, in terms of Caribbean slavery. And so I think that's what I saw, that Paine understood that nationalism, even as it was a powerful motivator. Right. I mean, Paine writes the first issue of The American Crisis is so stirring. Right. These are the times that try men's souls, that George Washington reads it to his troops before battle. Right. Because he knows this is going to inspire his men. So even as Paine is writing a certain type of nationalist discourse, he also understood that nationalism had its limitations and that it itself could block the way to human freedom.
As you're looking over a lot of these documents from the American revolutionaries who are, you know, attacking the British king and everything, did you ever run into some loyalists or the opposite side where you almost felt sorry for them or kind of understood their side as well?
Yeah. You know, I've been working. So after finishing this book, I decided, you know, I really do need to turn to the loyalist and think about those on the other side a little bit more than I do here. And you know, there are all sorts of things where, you know, loyalists in this one Massachusetts town or Connecticut town that I was looking at, there is a, you know, there are declarations in the newspapers published saying, you know, for all those loyalists who do not renounce the cause of the king, we want you to leave town by this date. And so what I began to look at in an article that I'll be publishing soon, I wanted to think about loyalists and their strategies for slowing down people like Tom Paine. How can you check the influence of a Samuel Adams? If Mercy Otis Warren is uplifting her countrymen and women and suggesting that they needed to partake in the American cause, how do you counter someone like Mercy Otis Warren? And so what I began to look at, and what in this forthcoming piece, is how various British or an American satirist loyal to the crown wrote in ways to slow down the patriot discourse. So going back to Common Sense, the key thing about Common Sense is that it can be read really quickly. One of the reasons my students like it, I think, it can be recited. It can be discussed in taverns. So if you have something like Common Sense, how can you obstruct it? How can you slow it down? If Ben Franklin is spilling leaks all across the continent, up and down the eastern seaboard, what can you do to, to mop that up? How can you mop up that spill? And so I became interested in the strategies of American loyalists to slow down that type of print discourse that was running out of control.
I know a lot of your book focuses on some links we might see with today, like Benjamin Franklin with WikiLeaks and things that have to do with fake news and that are very much with us. It strikes me that although there are these parallels, there are also some striking differences that things were at such a slow pace. If you sent a letter, there's nothing, you have to wait for that letter to be brought by horse, delivered. And just the spread is so slow back in the revolutionary time compared to now when news is old after an hour and you've got tweets and you've got just so many ways that information and misinformation is spreading all over the world in an instant. Did it also strike you as you're working on this book and your new piece, how different we are?
Yes and no. There is a certain, there's no way to keep pace with the volume or speed in which information bombards us today. It's hopeless. And even to archive what it is that is appearing in public today is it seems to be a fruitless quest. I mean, I was lucky in researching this book that I'm looking at. I think there are 37 colonial newspapers that I'm reading everything I can and people's letters, but it's a finite archive. Today, to understand what's going on, there is just so much. It's a deluge. And so if you think you're going to, somehow with a single sponge mop up all this, as misinformation, truth, fake news, it really is hopeless. So this piece that I was just writing, that I've just finished, it's called Information Warfare and Slow Media. But then the subtitle is really important. The subtitle is The Failure of Revolutionary Communication. And it's that notion of failure, because I show that even loyalists through the 1770s, through the 1780s, all while the Revolutionary War is waging, they were never going to win, right? Mm-hmm. Not the battle, but they were never going to win the rhetorical war either. They could never control the information channels. Their cause was hopeless. And so what they instead, I look at as a do, is they fantasize about not winning, not surviving, but the end of all communication together, all together. So let me just give you a couple examples. There are some poems, this famous one that's sort of what some people have called the first anti-war poem, American anti-war poem by this guy named Jonathan Sewall. He writes his poem and he talks about how he wishes he weren't writing this poem and how he says, "Oh, that my page were black, that nothing would appear upon it. Oh, that my ink were sulfur, so it would just combust." So all he can imagine at this time, and this is the failure, is if you want to stop communication from the other side, then you have to stop all communication. And he was okay with that, right? As a conservative loyalist, he's thinking, it's okay if we don't have public discourse. It's okay if, the crown and the king and the ministers, if they're just the ones talking, that's fine. But for us, I think this is what it means to live in a democracy, fortunately and unfortunately. We have this galaxy of text, of print, of tweets, of posts, of pictures.
Blogs, memes.
We could go on about this. And we can lament that, right? And we can say we need to put a stop to this. But once we do that, then we have,
we have a blank page.
We have a blank page. A page is just black. It's like, it's like as if we had gone over the newspaper with a black highlighter. And then we were at the end of it, we're just left with the only word that is innocuous would be like the articles or the prepositions, right? And so I think that's where we have to be very careful when we think about how do we want to combat or check or somehow slow this dissemination of material. It's a real warning shot. So what we need is maybe, do we need better filters? Do we need to, a phrase that is associated with Wisconsin, do we need to sift and winnow better? You tell me.
Well, I think what we need to do every 4th of July is to reflect on all kinds of information about freedom and speech going way back to our beginnings and also continuing today. And I thank my guest, Russ Castronovo, for enlightening the topic of propaganda. Thanks for joining me.
It was a pleasure.
I'm Emily Auerbach. I hope you join me for the next hour of University of the Year.